Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, is this economy benefiting you? Is it something you'll vote on? The stock market may be volatile, but the American economy is solid. Low unemployment, companies hiring, interest rates that remain fairly low, and a September consumer confidence number that was the highest in 18 years. And yet, if midterm polling is accurate, the party in power may not reap the kind of electoral rewards that they usually would when the numbers are this strong. Some of that is about President Trump, and we'll talk about why. Some of it is also about an economy that still feels precarious to too many Americans, and we'll talk about that, too. And here's where you come in. Take a moment to think about how your own household economy feels. Did you get a raise in the last year or so? Do you feel confident enough to make a big expenditure on your house? Are you starting to think about retirement because your savings look strong? So this is a moment to take stock of your own household economy and maybe use some of the measurements that I've just suggested, and then think along with us and call in, I hope, about whether you feel that this economy is benefiting you and how that's influencing the way you're thinking about the midterm election. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR. Amara Jones is with us. She's an economist and the host of the SIP podcast. Amara, that sounds very interesting. I'll have to listen. Welcome. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you. And you can also watch it, too.
All right. John Phelan is with us, economist with the Center for the American Experiment, based here in the Twin Cities and in the studio. John, welcome back. Good to have you on the show.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
John, if we were to use the objective measure of are you better off financially, not emotionally, but financially than you were 2 years ago, would most Americans have to say yes to that?
The statistics would seem to show that, yeah. We've had increased GDP growth in the US, GDP growing at a rate accelerated under the current administration than the previous administration.
Do most Americans feel that?
Well, they would feel it primarily in terms of wages. Now, if you look at the wage data, you'll often see that wages have grown from 2017 into 2018 by like 0.1%, which sounds pretty bad. But once you correct that, and a recent report from the Council of Economic Advisers did this. If you look at, if you use a more accurate inflation measure, if you look at the composition of the workforce, which is changing over time, then you actually see that the increase in wages has been 1% over the same period. And now that doesn't sound, you know, again, a great deal.
We're going to go into this in more detail, but go ahead. Finish.
But in
the
context, that's not a bad increase. Now, of course, if you make these adjustments backwards into the Obama administration, you see the same thing there. Wage rises were faster than the headline figures would suggest. But another thing you have to remember here is the effect of the tax cuts as well, because post in terms of post tax incomes, people would have seen their wages increase by 1.4%.
So we'll talk about wages here in a minute. John or Amara, to you, as far as not, I want to put aside kind of the emotional feeling of what this American moment feels like right now. I know there's a lot of noise out there about it, and there's a lot of people feeling unsettled financially. If you isolate the financial numbers, does this feel and look pretty good to average Americans?
You know, the thing about economics is that everything is relative. It's a relative game. So I think the issue is that relative to where we are 8 years ago, where we are is a miracle in terms of where we were and where we are now.
You mean the precipice of the recession
That's right. The Great Recession. which, you know, scarred the economy in some really key ways that we haven't recovered from. But the problem is that we don't, our economic lives, our lives don't exist only in the last 8 years. They exist over a period of time. And I think that if you look over a period of time, the economy is fair to middling. And one of the key problems is that the gains that we have had on a personal level, personal economic level, not mm-hmm. the macro level, mm-hmm. have not erased the scarring that I talked about in the economy from that last period. So that's one thing. People still have a tremendous amount of overhang from 8 years ago. And the other thing that's really important to remember is that there are other things that are happening in the economy besides wages that are wiping out those wage gains. We have tremendous inflationary pressures from the tariffs. We have inflationary pressures from the tax cut. We have tremendous debt that people both took on before the crisis and during the crisis that these wages that they are earning are not enabling them to work off. So if you're an average person, there's a tremendous drag on any of the gains that have been made recently, which is why both realistically and in terms of emotion, people on an average basis aren't feeling the change, aren't feeling the upswing.
You know, Amara, I have to say, I thought when you were going through that inflationary list, you were going to say healthcare, because I feel like of everything, that is an element of a budget that feels very precarious and unpredictable to people.
Particularly over, I'm glad you raised it. There's so many, it's hard to keep up with the entire list. But I mean, it's a really important point, particularly and especially over the last 2 years, because the current administration has done a series of things at the policy level to take off the brakes on premium increases. And so this year, we are going to see increases yet again after last year. And so all of these things together, that this entire list of inflationary pressures, the wiping out wage gains, these wages aren't enough to work off the overhang from the last crisis, they put together a recipe for the precariousness, for the uncertainty, because as studies have shown, half of Americans are just three paychecks away from poverty.
John,
and there's no way that you can feel comfortable with that sort of in the background.
John, we've been talking about healthcare a lot over the last couple of weeks, and I'm still getting, you know, residual tweets and insight from listeners. And I just got this from Amelia, which I think applies to what we've just said. Forced into paying for my daughter's health insurance, even though my coverage is more expensive than my ex-husband's. I pay for all her premiums, co-pays, medications, etc. Insurance helps, but it makes me always guess whether my surgeries and cancer scares are legitimate or not. There's that uncertainty around healthcare. Can you say something specifically about why that may be contributing to this feeling about the economy that isn't settled?
Well, one of the things I'd say about this feeling about the economy is that we can all find, you know, individual stories that suggest that there's this great unease out there. But if we look at the data, if you look at surveys of consumer confidence, they're actually quite high. And also, if you look at the GDP growth numbers that came out just the other week that showed annualized growth in the third quarter of 3.5%, following on from 4.2% in the second quarter. What you see there actually is that one of the big drivers of that GDP increase in the third quarter was consumer spending. So that doesn't suggest to me.
And the September, I want to say, the September consumer confidence numbers were the highest that they've been, I think, in 18 years or something.
Exactly. So that's not to say that there aren't problems. And I agree completely with Amara when we talk about the scarring that's happened as a result of the recession. That happens actually as a result of every recession. It's been pretty bad as a result of this last one. We have had this incredibly slow recovery over recent years. And I'm sure, you know, one thing that is a huge issue, and it's not just in this country, it's actually across the developed world, is slow labor productivity growth. Mm-hmm. It's been pretty much stagnant. We've done work at this at the state level. At the center, and it's pretty poor. You know, Minnesota workers are generally less productive than the national average, and that's not because the national average is great. We've stagnated in that, and productivity increases are really where it's the main source of economic growth.
It's a really good point, because it affects the way companies will see hiring and investment and wage growth. Let me come back to that in a minute, but let me take some calls here to Woody in Duluth. Hey, Woody. Hey, thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Yeah,
how's this feel to you?
The question about how it feels in the household, I think, first of all, I'm a father of a one-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
It's been about 10 years since I've been out of university. Coming out of university during the recession was pretty rough.
I'll bet.
So what I've learned in 10 years is that our economy is still quite fragile. We see that in the home front with the growing prices of groceries, certainly healthcare. When it came to having a birth, it was eye-opening. I lack the confidence that we're moving in the right direction. You know, Wall Street's doing just fine, but I don't think it's trickling down to middle-class working families.
And Woody, if I could just dig into that for a minute. I mean, you and your wife or partner made the decision to have a child.
Yes, that's correct.
You have wages coming into the household, right? What feels specifically precarious about this to you?
It's mostly the lack of, I wouldn't even call them luxuries. It's, we really regulate our finances and just recently got rid of internet because, we found that putting food on the table and, fixing the car were more pressing concerns.
Right. So how does that sound to you, Amara?
I think it sounds right. I think, when you look at a lot of consumer behavior that's driving the economy, it's fueled by, we all know that average people drive spending because once they get the dollars have to go out because, as we just heard, basic needs need to be met and adjustments are being made. But a lot of the froth in the spending, a lot of the driving of key drivers of a lot of consumer spending, which has been the underpinning of the American economy for the past 40, 45 years, are people who are at the higher end of income levels. And we're talking about people making $100,000 and above. And so we have to kind of disaggregate the data and look at where the ultimate confidence is, where the drivers are, to be able to get a whole picture. And I think that if you look at people like him, he tells the story that I was laying out, which is precariousness coming out of the recession, even though things are relatively good, not feeling particularly stable because of the inflationary pressures that we're talking about, not only the impact of tariffs and increased oil prices, which we haven't spoken about, which translate into food and other staples, but also healthcare. And so I think it sounds about right.
So I wanted to come back to this, John, what you brought up about productivity and bring in what Amara was saying about who's feeling the rewards of the economy and who isn't. Do you think this issue with productivity is affecting people in the middle to lower income tier and people in this $100,000 and above sphere of our economy aren't really affected by that? How does it work?
Well, absolutely. I think the sluggish and poor performance in productivity growth in recent years is a big factor in squeezing people's living standards. Because if you look at the data, you'll often see a very popular chart that shows productivity gains since 1973.
Yeah, I was just looking at that yesterday.
And wages kind of bumping along.
Right.
Now, if you correct that for inflation, more accurate inflation measures and various other things, you find that in actual fact, about 70 to 80% of the increase in productivity since, I think it's 1973, does go to work to the workers. Because one thing that doesn't do, for example, it just looks at wages, it doesn't look at full compensation. And one thing that you see is that compensation, the benefits, fringe benefits, healthcare and all the rest of it, are an increasing portion of workers' remuneration.
Again, the benefits that we're getting through our jobs, not necessarily salary increases. But,
exactly.
But go ahead with what you were saying about productivity.
Well, so I think, frankly, that's the biggest macro policy challenge that is faced in this country, in this state, in other countries, because if you don't have economic growth, that stops at all sorts of problems. And I think you can look at some of the political things that go on and see them as people being dissatisfied with reasonably stagnant economies. I mean, people say, you know, when the pie is growing, people don't worry so much about who's getting this slice and that slice. But once the pie stops shrinking, then it becomes a kind of zero-sum game and people trying to, you know, scrap for more at the expense of somebody else. Now, if you look at, you know, theory and data, they both show you, economic growth theory and data, both show you that the majority over anywhere you care to look of economic growth does stem from productivity increases. It's not from just dumping more and more capital inputs in.
Right.
It's not from just dumping in more and more workers in. It comes from the increased efficiency that you use these inputs with and the quality of the inputs themselves.
But
that's where we've kind of, you know, been treading water for about
10
years.
But I want to make sure I kind of interpret what you were saying there correctly. I think when you were alluding to the political environment that we're in and the zero-sum gain of this, what you mean is some of the concern about immigration and are there going to be enough jobs for Americans to work? Am I right? Is that what
you're
saying?
There's an element of that, yeah. I wouldn't say that all these concerns about issues such as immigration or whatever are driven solely by people's economic status.
But that is an element.
I think it's an element,
it,
certainly.
Right.
Yeah.
And it explains it in some ways in the midst of an economy that's good.
Yeah,
as,
I mean,
as
one thing I would say, there's a fantastic book, it's a few years old now, called The Moral Consequences of Economic Growth by a guy called Ben Friedman. And he looks back over the kind of long history of various countries, the US, France, Britain, and shows that political turbulence often comes in the wake of stagnant rising incomes.
Mm. Conversation here, if you've just gotten in on it, about how the economy, which is a very good one, but many Americans are not feeling all that settled. They still have this perception of precariousness about the economy, but the numbers look good. We're digging into some of those numbers, but we're also talking about how that's influencing the way people are thinking now, one week from today, out from making choices again in the midterm election for candidates. I mean, how does consumer confidence inform that? How does your own household budget inform that? John Phelan here with us from the Center for the American Experiment and Amara Jones, both of them are economists. And Amara Jones with us, a former Clinton aide and host of the SIP podcast. And I'm hearing from you this morning about how your own household economy feels about getting a raise, about do you feel confident enough to make a big expenditure? Are you starting to think about retirement, but you're feeling really unsettled about what happens next with the stock market and your investment? I think that would be, that'd be interesting for this conversation today. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at CarrieMPR. I also think it'd be interesting to hear, when was the last time you got a pretty decent raise? I think that's worth talking about, too. To Emily in Eden Prairie. Hi, Emily. Thanks so much for waiting. Hi.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. What's this look like for you?
So in our household, we are two working professionals with master's degrees in engineering. We've been working for about 8 years.
Uh-huh.
And we're competing in our wages with people that are outsourcing our positions in India and Czechoslovakia. And so they're paid significantly less than us. So we are not seeing big raises that we were anticipating when we started our career.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a young son who's 6 months old, and we're feeling the burden of childcare expenses that are greater than our monthly mortgage. So we feel unsettled with the economy, even though the numbers are good. And moving into the midterm elections, it's the biggest factor that we're looking at when we vote.
So this company, did you say that you and your husband are both engineers at the same company?
Different companies.
Different companies. And both companies are outsourcing some of this engineering work overseas.
Significantly.
Wow. Are you aware of that, Amara, of what's going on in this field?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a tremendous concern. Outsourcing has been. We know that outsourcing is moving up with what we call the value-added chain. That is to say, it's moving from call centers up to engineering, as she's saying, also legal services, various types of computer programming, which are also concerned. In the next economic downturn, there probably will be a huge surge, like there was in automation last time, to other new forms of technology which reduce labor costs, such as artificial intelligence and robotics. So there are lots of ways in which workers are concerned and should be concerned. I think that all of these from a policy standpoint are things that are not being addressed. And one other thing I just wanted to come to was this productivity question. You know, we know, for instance, that a key driver of productivity is health and healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that over the past 2 years, health outcomes in the United States have stagnated. That is to say, life expectancy has stagnated. We're even seeing it in decline for various populations. We also know that there's been a halt to HB1, B1 visas, which help bring people who are talented with unique skills into the United States. Those have been capped and are running out faster and faster. We know that there have been curbs to other forms of immigration. There are lots of things which contribute to productivity, health, the ability to have lots of people coming into the country that can produce, the ability to be able to turn people out in terms of education. And we've also seen education cuts be severe across the United States, which is why teachers across the country are increasingly getting involved in politics. So, again, even this productivity question, which undergirds, if you say that, well, one of the reasons why people aren't feeling it is because of our productivity mm-hmm. is stagnating, there are policy reasons undergirding that that translate into a lot of the things that we're hearing on these calls.
John, it looks like you agree with that.
There's a lot of truth in it. I mean, productivity, essentially, if you've got, you know, a fixed number of workers, you can increase their productivity by giving them more capital to work with. That will hit diminishing returns. You know, there's only so many shovels you can give somebody, for example. So what you need to do then is to improve the capital. So instead of giving them a shovel, give them a digger, you know, an earth mover, as I think you call them here. And then you can, and the other aspect of that is that you improve the quality of the workforce, and that's education. So I think those are the key drivers. It's innovation, investment, and education. And Imara's quite right that these things are all amenable and tractable by policy. In terms of investment, this is why I think that one of the good things that the administration has done has been the tax cuts, particularly the tax cut in the US corporate tax rate, which was very, very high. And people always say, well, there are all these exemptions and deductions. Trust me, America is not the only country in the world that has exemptions and deductions on its corporate tax. Other people have them as well. So I think that's one good thing that the administration has done.
But I mean, you've heard the debate, obviously, about who benefited most. One of the questions that I have about the tax cuts is it seems like many of these companies that are benefiting from the tax cuts had huge stockpiles of capital already, and that they were not. I mean, some of the questions has been, what is it going to take for some of these companies to invest more of that capital that they're holding?
Well, that would be based on their estimate of the returns, and that will be impacted by the tax cuts.
Before this, going into the tax cuts, go ahead.
I think what they will see now is that if they invest, you know, a certain amount in plants or whatever, then they will see a greater return on that. I think one of the problems that you have, and if you look at the data for the third quarter of the year, business investment wasn't actually a huge contributor to the economic growth that we saw. And that's something that might, you know, seem a bit confusing.
It's puzzling.
Yeah, well, it's less puzzling when you look at other factors that go into it. For starters, one of the problems that you have here is the uncertainty. You know, I mean, are these
how
tax
many
cuts,
years are companies going to be using uncertainty as an excuse not to invest?
Well, they're perfectly entitled to use it as long as this uncertainty continues. And look, I mean, you've got one of the parties that's running in the elections at the moment saying that they'll reverse these tax cuts. I mean, if you're sat there thinking, should
I
invest?
That would be the Democrats.
Yeah, you're thinking mm-hmm. to yourself, you know, well, if I invest now, what's going to happen? I mean, the economic literature is very, very clear on this, that uncertainty about the future is a big hindrance to investment decisions. And we have that. You know, and also one of the bad things that this administration has done is its ridiculous stance on trade and tariffs. I mean, that there is a real problem. And I think that's something that does also impact on productivity, because openness to trade does improve productivity. Evidence shows that.
Let me grab a call here from Liz in Minneapolis. Hi, Liz. How does this economy feel to you and your own household?
Hi. It's feeling really good at the moment, actually. I would say this is probably the most confident I've ever been about my personal finances. Wow. And a big part of that is that I finally paid off my student loans after 10 years of making payments.
Congratulations. What a weight off your mind, huh?
Exciting.
I hope you celebrate it. It's good.
Yeah.
So what are you doing with all the extra money?
Well, I just got married a few months ago. Uh-huh. So my new husband and I are making plans to do a delayed honeymoon and do some more traveling, but also just building up savings finally after many years of putting almost everything towards the loan payment.
Wow. And are you feeling, you're feeling pretty secure in your career? You're feeling secure that you can advance economically in the field that you're in?
Advancing and moving up is not a sure thing, but I did start a new job pretty recently at a higher pay rate, which is certainly helping.
Wow. So you've had a lot of transitions in the last few years. Good to have the call, Liz. Thanks. Amar, a question for you about, I see a lot of hiring ads. I mean, and they're on the sides of trucks. I've noticed this a lot on my commute. They're on billboards. They're in company windows. Are the companies that are advertising and can't seem to find the number of employees that they need, is it because they're struggling because there simply aren't enough Americans who are willing to do that work? Is it because these individual companies don't pay, you know, a wage that is competitive enough? What's the problem?
I mean, that's hiring is always a complex issue and problem. I mean, businesses say that that they can't find enough qualified people in certain areas and in certain specialties. That may be true. Like there's certain types of robotics where that's definitely true. But it's also the case that generally speaking, training and education problems fix themselves if the labor market is signaled that there'll be a payoff. So potential workers will acquire the skills that they need if they are sure that the wages that they will get from that will be greater than the cost of investing in moving or education or any of the other things that are necessary in order for that to happen and to take place. And so it could be in a lot of these places that the wages just aren't keeping up with that. We do know that wages are increasing, as we've said, but they're also outweighed by these inflationary pressures. So that means that wages need to be perhaps even higher. It's also can be a case of where the jobs are. So are the jobs located in places where people want to move? Do they give the type of circumstances where people want to live and educate their kids and have the type of communities where people want to live? And so just as important are exactly what the wages are outweighed by the cost of getting those wages. And secondly, where are you moving to and what does that look like? Those are two really important factors that, you know, just seeing wanted signs can't communicate.
Right.
But I also wanted to return really quickly, if I could, to this idea of taxes and what's happened with business investment.
Can I, if you'll hold that for just a second, I just want to ask
sure.
John about the hiring and then let me come back to the tax cuts.
Sure.
John, what's your take on whether these companies simply aren't paying enough, they can't find the right people with the right skills? What is it?
Well, I think there's a bit of both, and I agree to a very large extent with what Amara said. I mean, we hear a lot about a labor shortage in Minnesota, for example.
Right.
But what you're talking about there is a shortage at the current price. Whenever economists talk about a shortage, there's a shortage at the current price. And if the price was higher, then the shortage would go away. So, and in, obviously, in the, if you're talking about labor markets, you're talking about wages as the price. Now, you're starting to see wages move up. And overall remuneration packages move up, particularly in states like Minnesota, you're seeing that after a prolonged period of stagnation. But that's not to say that all of this is just, you know, miserly employers trying to complain about having to pay higher wages. There is also an element of a skills mismatch. We do have, you know, for example, there are jobs to be had in things like welding or being lineman. You can, after about 2 years at training, you can walk into like a $50,000, $60,000 a year job there. And they're having trouble finding people to do that. There's an awful lot of education going on, you know, in terms of K-12 and universities, colleges and things like that. But is it really fitting people for the needs of the labor force? Now, is that the job of education? You know, that's another discussion to have. But I do think it's absolutely true that there is this mismatch of skills.
We've had so many conversations about what corporate America needs and what training and education facilities are not supplying. And I've had guests say this mismatch on skills is a fallacy. It's because companies themselves don't want to train. They want somebody to walk in the door with the skills, and that's ridiculous because, you know, it goes on and on.
There's an element of both. There's part of the difficulty with anecdote versus data. You know, I've spoken to companies that tell me the exact opposite, and people will generally find themselves speaking to people who confirm their priors. It's funny that. But I think that when you look at the situation that you have with these skills and whatnot, there is an element as well that, and this is where there's a social aspect to this in terms of attitudes. I was talking to somebody about this a little while ago, somebody, you know, who's complaining about, like some of the callers we've heard about making ends meet. And I suggested some of these potential manual work jobs. Mm. And they said, well, I don't fancy doing that. And I thought to myself, well, you know, and I'm not saying that, you know, we've got hordes of lazy people out there who don't want to become welders. But there is a kind of, it seems to me, a cultural... These jobs are perceived somewhat differently to what they used to be in the old days.
Right. MRI, I have to give you a chance on the tax cuts. What do you want to say?
Yeah, really quickly. One of the things that we've seen with the tax cuts because of the way they were structured is that companies aren't investing. They're taking billions and billions of dollars and buying back stock, which has no impact in terms of economic growth at all. That means that the benefits of the tax cuts, in terms of every study that's been done, the benefits of the tax cuts for corporations have been for them to use the capital, increased cash flow, and buy back stock, which does two things. It overinflates the stock market, and it means that we aren't getting the necessary investments in the things that will actually fix some of the things that we are talking about this morning. And that's because of policy that was written. That's the way that the tax code was structured. And secondly, I think what's really important about the tax code and policy is that, you know, we can write it, and things can be written in a way to structure the outcomes that we want. And there are lots of examples that we could go through in which there's some very severe problems with this tax code. Now, all of the solutions that are being proposed by the Democrats don't actually impact the things that we were talking about earlier, drive the economy. The things that are being talked about rolled back aren't on the investment side, aren't on the equipment side, aren't on any of the things, aren't on the research and innovation side. They're the examples of allowing people to write off higher levels of capital gain, lower capital gains taxes. It's rolling back this provision of the way in which we tax stock buybacks so that it drives stock prices in companies. And so it's important to realize that there's some fundamental problems with the way that the tax code is written, which is preventing some of the benefits from filtering down.
I have not reserved enough time for this conversation. I can see that now, because we're also going to talk about K-12 and early childhood education here in the rest of the hour. Imara, thank you. Really great to have you on the show. John, always a pleasure.
Thanks
to have you
back
in the studio.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.